Chapter 2. "Another misery of human life," remarked Stephen to the morning darkness, "is having a contubernal that snores like 10. "I was not snoring," said Jack. "I was wide awake." "What's a contubernal?" "You are a contubernal. And you're another. I was wide awake. And I was thinking about Sunday. If Raffles Stores come in, we shall rig church by way of Thanksgiving, eat a full ration of plum duff, and observe the rest of the day as a holiday. Then on Monday we shall set to..." "What was that noise?" "Not thunder, heaven preserve." "It was only Chips and the bosun stealing away without a sound. They and their party mean to lay out the work early and start the tar kettle a-going well in advance, and Joe Gower's taking his fish gig in the hope of some of those well-tasting stingrays that lie in the shallows by night. You'll smell the smoke and the tar presently if you pay attention." They lay there, paying mild attention, for several wholly relaxed, luxurious minutes. But it was not the smell of tar that brought Jack Aubrey leaping from his hammock. From down by the slip came a furious, confused bellowing, the sound of blows, an immensely loud, bubbling scream that died in agony. It was still dark when he reached the breastwork, but lights were moving about down there and over the sea. The flames under the tar kettle seemed to show the loom of a considerable vessel just offshore. But before he could be certain of it, the first of the carpenter's party came scrambling up the hill. "What's happened, Jenning?" he asked. "They killed Hadley, sir. They killed Joe Gower. Black men are stealing our tools." "Beat to quarters," cried Jack. And as the drum thundered, several more hands came up the slope, the last half carrying the bosun between them, pouring blood as he came. Then, first light in the east, false dawn, the red rim of the sun, and all at once full, brilliant day. The largest double-hulled proa Jack had ever seen was lying a few yards off the mouth of the slip, close enough at low tide for dense lines of men to wade out carrying tools, cordage, sailcloth, metalwork, while on the shore still others were gathered, some round their dead friends, some round their dead enemies. "May I fire, sir?" asked Welby, whose marines had lined the breastwork. "At that distance and with doubtful powder, no. How many charges do your men possess?" "Most have two, sir, in moderate condition." Jack nodded. "Mr. Reed," he called, "my glass, if you please, and pass the word for the gunner." The telescope brought the shore startlingly close. They were carefully cutting off the carpenter's head. Gower and another man he could no longer identify had already lost theirs. There were two dead Malays or Dyaks, and even at this juncture he was shocked to see that one was Kesegaran. Although she was now wearing Chinese trousers, and although she'd been pierced through and through, she was perfectly recognisable, lying there looking fiercely up at the sky. Jennings was still at his side, still voluble from the shock. "It was Joe Gower that done it," he said. "Mr. White went for to stop her taking his broad axe. She slashed his leg out of hand, and as he lay there, she slit his throat quick as whistlejack. He screamed like a pig. So Joe served her out with his fish gig. It came natural to him, being a queen, as they say, and carpenter's mate." "Sir," said the gunner. "Mr. White, let the carronades be drawn and reloaded with grape. What do you say to their charges?" "I shouldn't like to answer with a piece forward, sir, but the 9-pounder and the after carronade may do their duty. At least change the old flannel for something dry, mix in a little priming and let them air. Those people will be busy down there for quite a while." He turned to his first lieutenant and said, "Mr. Fielding, boarding pikes and cutlasses have been served out, I'm sure." "Oh, yes, sir." "Then let the people go to breakfast watch by watch, and pray search all possible sources for powder, flasks, fowling pieces, pistols that may have been overlooked, rockets. Ah, doctor, there you are. You've seen what's afoot, I dare say." "I have a general notion. Should you like me to go down and parley, make peace, if it's at all possible?" "Do you know that Kesegaran was there and has been killed?"
"I did not," said Stephen, looking very grave.
"Take my glass. They've not carried her back to the proa yet. From the way they're behaving, I don't think any truce is possible, and you'd be killed at once. In an encounter like this, one side or the other has to be beaten entirely. Ah, sure, you're in the right of it. Killick put a tray on the earthwork, and they sat either side of it, looking over the slip and the busy dyaks below. How's the bosun? Asked Jack, putting down his cup. We've sewn him up, said Stephen, and unless there is infection, he'll do. But he'll never dance again. One of his wounds was a severed hamstring. He loved a hornpipe, poor fellow, and the Irish trot. Do you see they're putting on whitish jackets? The Dayak guard at Prabang wore them. Wandar told me they'd toddled a bullet, being padded with kapok. They watched in silence for the space of 2 coffee pots. Most of the immediate looting had stopped, and now the space round the slip was bright with spearheads catching the sun. Finishing his cup, Captain Aubrey called, Mr. Welby there, what do you make of the situation? I believe they mean to attack, sir, and to attack in an intelligent way. I've been watching that old gentleman with a green headcloth who directs them. This last half hour he's been sending off little parties into the trees on our left. Several go, but only a few come back, waving branches and calling out so that they shall be seen. And then more men have been quietly moved under the bank this side of the slip, where we can't see them. Dead ground for us. I think his plan is to send a large body straight at us. Charge right uphill, engage on the earthwork, kill as many as they can, and then fall back slowly, still fighting, and then turn and run so that we shall leave our lines and pursue them, whereupon the group in the forest will take us in the flank, while the people in the dead ground jump up and the first attacking party face about and between them cut us to pieces. After all, they're rather better than 300 to our 150-odd. You've been there before, Mr. Welby, I find, said Jack, looking sharply into the trees on the left where the gleam of weapons could, in fact, be made out quite easily. I have seen a good deal of service, sir, said Mr. Welby. As he spoke, a swivel gun and a jingle flashed aboard the proa. The gun's half-pound ball kicked up earth on the breastwork. The jingle's bullet, probably a rounded stone, passed overhead with a wavering howl. This seemed to be the whole of the Dayak's artillery. No muskets were to be seen, and immediately after the discharge, the white-jacketed spearmen began forming below. After a quick, low-voiced exchange with Jack, Welby called, Marines! One shot, one man. No one's to leave the lines. Independent fire. No one is to shoot without is sure of killing his man. No marine is to reload, but having fired is to fix his bayonet. Sergeant, repeat the orders. The sergeant did so, adding, having cleaned his lock and barrel if time permits. Now an ululation, the beating of a small, shrill drum, and the spearmen came racing up the hill in groups. A first, nervous musket at 100 yards. Sergeant, take that man's name. Nearer, and their panting could be heard. The last stretch, 20 or 30 musket shots, and in a close-packed, shouting melee, they were on the earthwork. Spears, pikes, swords, bayonets clashing, dust flying, clouds of dust. And then, at a huge shout from some chief man, they fell back, at first slowly, still facing the camp, then faster, turning their backs and fairly running away. A dozen ardent foremast jacks ran after them, bawling like hounds. But Jack, Fielding and Richardson knew each by name and roared them back to the lines. Fools, half-wits, great hulking girls. The fleeing Dayaks stopped halfway down and gathered to mock and challenged the camp with marks of scorn. Forward carronade, called Jack, fire into the brown. The flint failed at the first pull of the lanyard, a frightful anticlimax, but it fired on the second, and the carronade uttered a flat poop, scattering a gentle shower of grape among the Dayaks, who howled with laughter, capered and leapt into the air. Some of them waved their penises at the English, others showed their buttocks, and the powerful reinforcement from the trees came running out to join them for a charge in deadly earnest. After carronade, said Jack, and his voice was instantly followed by a great solemn crash and a cloud of orange-lined smoke. While the echoes were still going to and fro, the cloud swept to leeward, showing the awful swathe the grape had cut. There was a headlong flight to the slip, and although some came back, creeping low to help their wounded friends back down the hill, they left at least a score of dead. Now there followed a long period with no action, well on into the afternoon. But it soon became clear that the Dyaks and their Malay friends, for they were a mixed crew, hadn't lost heart. There was a great deal of movement down by the slip and between the slip and the proa, and from time to time they fired the swivel gun. At noon, they lit their fires for a meal. The camp did the same. All this time, Jack had been watching the enemy with the closest attention, and it was clear to him and his officers that Old Green Headcloth was certainly in command down there. The Dyak chief watched the English with equal care, often standing on the bank with shaded eyes. And a good hand with a rifle, having an earthwork to lean on, could certainly bring him down. Stephen could do it, he was sure. But he knew with equal certainty that Stephen never would. In any case, both medicos were busy with the wounded. Several men had been hurt in the fighting on the breastwork. Nor would he do it himself, not in cold blood and at a distance. Although he wasn't displeased when a broadside cleared an enemy quarterdeck, there was still something illogically sacred about the person of the opposing commander, and some perceptible but indefinable difference between killing and murder. Query, did it apply to a man appointed as a sharpshooter? Answer, it did not. Nor did it apply in even a very humble melee. Captain Aubrey, his officers, and David Edwards, the envoy secretary, ate their dinner on trestle planks laid this side of the breastwork, which had sandbags on its top to protect their heads from the not infrequent swivel gun, whose layer made remarkably good practice, hitting the embankment or skimming just over it almost every time. Such good practice that the moment they saw the flash, all hands dropped to their knees out of direct range. Their genuflection didn't always save them, however, and twice during the meal Dr. Maturin was called away to deal with the more sluggish. Dinner today was informal, so much so that Richardson might, without impropriety, peer between the sandbags with his telescope and say, "It's my belief, sir, that the enemy are entirely out of water. I see three parties trying to make holes in what they take to be the watercourse, and Green Headcloth is blackguarding them like a fish fag." "They expected to be drinking out of our well by now," said Welby, smiling. "Though, mark you, they may do so yet," he added as a sop to fate. "The odds are more even now," observed the purser, "and if it goes on at this rate, we shall soon have the advantage. If that should come about, they'll surely sail away and come back three times as strong," said the master. "Sir, would it be foolish to suggest destroying their proa out of hand? It's frail past belief, no metal, and its whole construction, and a ball in either hull, or better still at the junction between them, would knock it to pieces." "I dare say it would, Mr. Warren," said Jack, "but that would leave us with better than 200 thirsty villains eating us out of house and home. The doctor says there are barely a score of pigs left and only a few days' ration of ring-tailed apes. No, there's nothing I should like better than seeing them weigh and set off for reinforcements. Almost all our long sawing is done, and very fortunately poor dear Mr. Hadley had left several of his most important tools up here for sharpening and resetting. Working double tides, I believe we can launch the schooner and be on our way to Batavia before they come back. Their home port is certainly in Borneo." "Oh," cried the purser, as though he'd been struck by a new idea, but he said no more. The swivel gun and the jingle both hit the sandbag immediately opposite, ripping it and covering both him and the table with its contents. When they picked him up, he was dead. Stephen opened his shirt, put his ear to his chest and said, "Heart, I'm afraid. God be with him." During the hot, still hours that followed, Jack, Fielding and the gunner overhauled the powder, all that had been found, scraped from barrels, withdrawn from flasks and bandoliers, signal cartridges and even rockets. "We have a charge for each of the carronades and the nine-pounder, with just enough over to leave the doctor half a flask for his rifle," said Jack. "Master Gunner, it might be well to load them now while the metal hardly bears touching. The heat will make the powder brisk. And let the nine-pounder ball be very carefully chipped, indeed oiled and polished." "Aye, aye, sir. Grape for the carronades, I do suppose. Case is your real slaughterhouse charge at close quarters, but I'm afraid we have none." The gunner shook his head with a melancholy air. "All on that fucking reef, sir, pardon me." "Then grape, Mr. White."
"Sir, sir," cried Bennett, "Captain Welby says they're sending men up through the forest."
"Perhaps, sir," said Welby, when Jack joined him at his lookout point, "it would be prudent not to direct your glass. They might think we'd smoked them. But if you watch the open ground to the left of that great crimson-flowering tree at 11 o'clock from the flagstaff, you'll see them slip across, their spearheads held low and wrapped in leaves or grass. What do you think they're at?" "I believe they're a forlorn hope. A storming party sent to attack the camp from behind where the silver is. They're to catch up a chest or two and run off into the broken country behind while their friends amuse us with a false attack in front. They can't know what the back of the camp's like. We can hold it with half a dozen men. There's a shocking great drop where the landslide swept the earth away." "No, sir. And as the young person came in by the west gate and left by the south, she wouldn't have seen the drop either. No doubt it's all their general's theory, but still I'm sure he thought he could rely on surprise. How many men did you reckon?" "I counted 29, sir, but I may well have missed a few." "Well, I think we can deal with that. Mr. Reed, stop that goddamn fool pointing at the tree. Stop it at once, do you hear me there? You and Harper can pick up the biggest stones you can carry and take them to the north wall steps at the double. Mr. Welby, I think we can afford a round apiece to your 8 best marksmen. A quarter of your people down before you start your attack is discouraging. It'll be uncommon brave men that go on with such a rise in front of them." Almost at once the diversion began. The swivel gun and the jingle fired as fast as they could. Large bodies of men raced diagonally across and across the broad open slope between the camp and the building slip, hallooing as they ran or howling like gibbons. And presently there was a furious discharge of crackers along the inner border of the forest. Jack had to shout to make himself heard. "Mr. Seymour, there's a forlorn hope about to make a dash for the silver by way of the north wall. Take Killick and Bondon and the 8 marines Mr. Welby has told off together, with whatever other men you need, to line the wall and deal with the situation, while we watch their attempt at amusing us and make sure it don't turn ugly." The feint, the diversion, did not turn ugly. The real attack did. The storming party had been picked for strength and courage, and in spite of a heavy loss, the moment they left cover, they ran straight onto the steps and the foot of the wall, where Killick, beside himself with pale hatred and fury, flung great stones down upon them. Helped on either hand by the marines, all the captain's bargemen and his coxswain. Again and again, a Dyack would make a back for another, and up he would come, spear poised, only to be flung back at pike point, pierced through with a cutlass or smashed with a 50-pound stone. And presently there were no more to come. Seymour, nominally in command, had to beat on the men's backs to prevent them stoning the few dreadfully shattered cripples who were crawling off among the rocks. Even then Killick stood for a great while livid and glaring, a boarding axe in one hand and a jagged lump of basalt in the other. The diversion soon lost all conviction. The diagonal running to and fro grew languid. The crackers spluttered away to one last pop. The sun, too, was tiring of the day. It had been extraordinarily hot, and sloped westward through a deeper blue. "Yet even so, sir," said Welby, "I do not believe this is the end. Their general has lost a power of men, and he has nothing to show for it. They have no water. See how they dig. And they won't find any there, so they cannot wait. The general cannot wait.
As soon as they've rested a little, he'll launch the whole lot at us, straight at us. He's a death or glory cove, I'm sure. See how he harangues them, jumping up and down. Oh, my God, they fired the schooner! As the black smoke billowed up and away on the shifting breeze, the whole camp burst out in a yell of desperate anger, frustration, plain grief. Jack raised his voice and hailed the gunner. Mr. White! Mr. White there! Draw those carronades and reload with the very best round shot we possess. Your mates have perhaps 5 minutes to chip them as smooth as ever they can, certainly not more. And, Mr. White, let there be slow match at hand. This time, there were no manoeuvres, no diversions. They came steadily up the hill, at first at a trot, and lastly at a furious run. They came straight at the guns with no sign of fear, but in no kind of formation either, so that they reached the earthwork in dispersed order, the fleetest first, in tens rather than fifties, and they never beat their way through the mast, pikes and bayonets. Their chief arrived in the second wave, still running, but scarcely able to see or fetch his breath. He leapt onto a body, slashing blindly at the seaman opposite him, and fell back, his head split down the middle with an axe. It was cruel fighting. Kill or be killed, all in a great roar of sound and the clash of swords and spears, grunting and dust, sometimes a shriek. For what seemed a great while, the enemy never fell back except for another spring forward. But the Dyaks and Malays were fighting uphill against an enemy in close contact with strong-voiced, competent naval and military commanders and sheltered by a moderate breastwork. Besides, however great their courage, they were smaller, lighter men than the English. And at a given point, when there was a general withdrawal on the right and the centre, a regrouping for a fresh assault, Jack Aubrey felt the turn of the tide. He called out, "Mr. Welby, charge! Dyans, follow me!" The whole camp leapt onto the wall with a cheer. The drum beat and they hurled themselves forward. After the first frightful clash, the marines' weight and their exact order bore all before them. It was a rout, a total disastrous rout. The Dyaks ran for their lives. They ran faster than the English, and on reaching the sea they leapt straight in and swam fast to the proa, as nimble as otters, perhaps 100 men left. Jack stood gasping on the shore, his sword dangling from his wrist. He wiped the blood from his eyes, blood from some unfelt blow, looked at the blazing schooner, its ribs outlined in fire, and at the Dyaks already hauling on their cable. "Mr. Fielding," he said in a strong, hoarse voice, "see what can be done to put out the fire. Mr. White, gun crews, I say, come along with me." They toiled up again, those that were whole, and never before had Jack so felt the burden of his weight. The bodies lay thick halfway to the camp, thicker in front of the earthwork, but he hardly noticed as he picked his way through just by the brass 9-pounder. Bondon, the captain of the gun and a faster runner, gave him a hand over the parapet and said, "They're underway, sir." He looked round, and there indeed was the proa luffing up, coming as close to the awkward breeze as ever she could sail. The tide had been on the ebb long enough to bear the reef, and she had to get all possible offing on the unhandy starboard tack to weather the west point with its shocking tide rip and northward setting current. The gunner, helped by his surviving mate, arrived a moment later. "There's more match in my tent, sir," he called in a voice that hardly carried over the breastwork. "Never fret about that, Mr. White," said Jack, smiling. "The first still has half a glass to go." And there it was, in fact, untouched, unkicked in the turmoil and confusion of battle, smouldering away in its tubs, its smoke drifting away across the empty camp. "God love us," whispered the gunner as they crouched there, laying the forward carronade. "I thought the set to was much longer." 4 degrees, would you say, sir?" "Pitch it well up, Master Gunner." "Well up it is, sir," said the gunner, giving the screw half another turn. For a perceptible instant, the match hissed on the priming. The carronade spoke out loud and sharp, screeching back along its slide. All hands peered out and under the smoke, a and some caught the high, curving flight of the ball. Jack watched it so intently that only his heart remembered to rejoice that the powder had proved sound, beating so hard it almost stopped his breath. The line was true, the ball short by 20 yards. Jack ran to the 9-pounder, calling to the captain of the other carronade, 4.5, will it fire as she rises? The carronade fired an instant later. A noble crash once more. This time Jack didn't see the ball. But there was its white plume in the sea just ahead of the proa, the line as true as the last. He heaved on his handspike, shifting the lay of the gun a trifle to the right, called, "Stand by there!" and clapped the match to the touch-hole. At the same moment, the proa's helmsman put his tiller hard over to avoid the shot and sailed straight into the point of its fall. There was no splash. For an instant, all hands looked blank. Then the two hulls fell apart. The great sail collapsed, the entire vessel disintegrated, and the hole, already spread over 20 or 30 yards of sea, drifted fast towards the west point and its terrible overfall. "What's the cheering?" asked Stephen, coming bloody-handed from the hospital tent and peering mole-like through spectacles he now wore for the fine work of surgery. "We've sunk the proa," said Jack. "You can see the wreckage sweeping past the cape. They'll be in the tide rip directly. Lord, how it cuts up, and no man living can swim through that. But at least we don't have to fear any reinforcements." "You take your pleasures rather sadly, brother, do you not? They fired the schooner, do you see? And from what little I saw, there's no hope of saving a single frame." Fielding heaved himself wearily over the corpses and the parapet, took off his battered hat and said, "Well, sir, I give you joy of your glorious shot. Never was there such a genuine smasher. And I'm very sorry to have to report that although several hands got burnt in their zeal, there is nothing, nothing we could do to save the schooner. There's not a single frame left entire, left at all. Even the keelson's gone. And, of course, all the planking, as well as the cutter. I'm heartily sorry for it, Mr. Fielding," said Jack, in a voice intended as a public communication. A score of men were within earshot. "I'm sure you and all hands did their best, but it was a hopeless blaze by the time we reached it. It certainly spread tar fore and aft. However, here we are alive and most of us fit for duty. We have many of poor Mr. Hadley's tools. There's timber all around us, and I have no doubt we shall find a solution." He hoped the words sounded cheerful and that they carried conviction, but he couldn't be sure. As it usually happened after an engagement, a heavy sadness was coming down over his spirits. To some degree it was the prodigious contrast between two modes of life. In violent hand-to-hand fighting there was no room for time, reflection, enmity, or even pain, unless it was disabling. Everything moved with extreme speed, cut and parry with a reflex as fast as a sword thrust, eyes automatically keeping watch on 3 or 4 men within reach, arm lunging at the first hint of a lowered guard, a cry to warn a friend, a roar to put an enemy off his stroke, and all this in an extraordinarily vivid state of mind, a kind of fierce exultation, an intense living in the most immediate present. Whereas now, time came back with all its deadening weight. A living in relation to tomorrow, to next year, a flag promotion, children's future. So did responsibility, the innumerable responsibilities belonging to the captain of a man of war. And decision. In battle, eye and sword arm made the decisions with inconceivable rapidity. There was no leisure to brood over them, no leisure at all. Then again, there were all the ugly things to be done after a victory. And the sad ones, too. He looked round for a midshipman, for by now most of the people had come up the hill again. But seeing none, he called Bondon, the invulnerable Bondon, and told him to ask the doctor whether a visit would be convenient.
"Aye, Archer," said Bondon.
and hesitated.
Which you have a nasty trough up there.
Tapping his scalp. That it ought to be looked to at the same time.
So I have, said Jack, feeling his head. But it don't signify. Cut along now.
Before Bondon could come back, Richardson limped up to say that the Dyaks had taken the heads not only of the carpenter and his mate, but of all those killed on the lower or middle ground. Some couldn't be identified. Should the bodies be brought up? Were our own dead by the camp to be separated by religion? What was to be done with the dead natives?
Sir, said Bondon, with a queer look on his face, doctor's compliments and in 5 minutes, if you please.
Every man has his own 5 minutes. Jack's was shorter than Stephen's, and he came into the tent too early. Stephen was carrying a slender arm to a heap of amputated limbs and the bodies of patients who had already died. He put it down on a shattered foot and said, "Show me your scalpel, you know, sit on this barrel." "Whose was that arm?" asked Jack.
"Reed's," said Stephen. "They've just taken it off at the shoulder."
"How is he? May I speak to him?" "Will he be all right?"
"With the blessing he may do well," said Stephen, "with the blessing. That swivel gun flung him down with his head against a rock, and he's still stunned entirely. Sit on the barrel. Mr. Macmillan, hot water and the coarse shears, if you please."
As he mopped and snipped, he said, "Of course, I've not a full list for you, since not all the dead have been counted, and there are still some wounded to be brought up the hill. But I'm afraid it will be a long one. The midshipman's berth has suffered very heavily. Your clerk was killed in the charge, so was little Harper. Bennett was virtually disemboweled, and though we've sewn him up, I doubt he sees tomorrow.
Butcher, Harper, Bennett, Reed. Dead or maimed."
As Jack sat there, with his head bowed to the swab, the shears and the probe, tears fell steadily on his folded hands. The first sad, weary days of mass burial, more dead men both sides taken together than living, and the visiting of the wounded, seeing faces he'd known all his commission, good, decent faces, almost all of them, yellow and thin with pain, sometimes with fatal infection, lying there in the heat and the dreadful, familiar smell. Then the later funerals, as the worst cases dropped off, one, two, and even three a day. And all this with extremely little food. Stephen had shot only one small Barbarossa. The apes were no longer worth his remaining charges, and of the few fishes caught by casting from the rocks or hauling the seine, most were scaleless, lead-coloured things that even the gulls wouldn't eat. On the morning after the last patient on the Dangerless died, a young Dyak, who had borne resection after resection of his gangrenous leg with admirable fortitude, Stephen was late in obeying the pipe of "all hands on deck, all hands aft" that preceded the captain's address to the ship's company. By the time he slipped into his place, Jack was still dealing with naval law, the perennity of commissions, the articles of war, and so on. All hands listened attentively with grave, judicial expressions as he repeated his main points once again, particularly that which had to do with the continuance of their pay, each according to his rating, and the compensation in lieu of spirits not served out. They stood there, close-packed, confined between imaginary rails, exactly as though they were still aboard the Diane, and they weighed every word. Stephen, who had heard the essence before, paid little attention. In any case, his mind was elsewhere. He'd been attached to the Dyak, who showed unlimited trust in his skill and benevolent intent, who would take food only from him, and whom he really thought he'd saved, as he had, in fact, saved young Reed, now sitting there wraith-like on a carronade slide, his empty sleeve pinned across his chest, and as he had saved Edwards, who stood alone there where the envoy and his suite had always had their place.
"But now, shipmates," said Jack in his strong, deep voice, "I come to another point. You have all heard of the Widow's Cruise. No single officer, seaman or marine showed the least sign of having heard of the Widow's Cruise, nor any sign whatever of intelligence. Well," continued Captain Aubrey, "Diane shipped no Widow's Cruise. And by that I mean tomorrow is St. Famine's Day." Comprehension, alarm, despondency, extreme displeasure showed in the faces of all the old men-of-war's men present, and the hum of whispered explanation kept Jack silent for a long moment. "But it's not the worst St. Famine I've ever known," he went on, "although it is true that today's is the last issue of grog and the last cheese-pairing scrap of tobacco. We still have a little biscuit and a cask of Dublin horse not very badly spoilt, and there's always the chance that the doctor may knock down another of the island gazelles. And there is this point, too. The officers and I are not going to sit on silk cushions swilling wine and brandy. The gunroom steward and Killick are going to put all our stores into a general pool under double guard. And as long as it lasts, each mess will draw its share by lot. That is what the gunroom steward and Killick are going to do, whether they like it or not." This was very well received. Killick's extreme jealousy of the captain's stores, even the oldest heel-taps of his wine, had always been notorious, and the gunroom steward's hardly less so. Both looked pinched and intensely disapproving, but the ship's company in general laughed as they'd not laughed since before the battle. "Then again," said Jack, "God helps those that help themselves. We still have Ned Walker and two others who are rated carpenter's crew. We still have plenty of sailcloth and a fair amount of cordage. We can save many of the nails and spikes from the schooner's ashes, and my plan is to run up a six-oared cutter to replace the one they burnt, pick a crew of our best seamen with an officer to navigate, and send them off to Batavia for help. I shall stay here, of course." All these things coming at once confused his audience. Upon the whole, there was a hum of agreement, even a very strong approval, but one man called out, 200 mile in an open boat with a monsoon, like the change. Bligh sailed 4,000 in a 23-foot launch crammed with people. Besides, the monsoon doesn't change for close on a fortnight, and even a parcel of grass-combing lubbers can put a seaworthy cutter together in that length of time. In any case, what's the alternative? Sit here and watch the sun go down on the last of the ring-tailed apes? No, better a dead dog than a lead lion. That's to say, 3 cheers for Captain Aubrey's plan," cried a perfectly unexpected voice, a taciturn, highly respected middle-aged forecastleman named Nickel. "Hip, hip, hip!" The cheering was still going on when Stephen, with his rifle in the crook of his arm, walked down past the blackened wreckage in the slip. The skeleton with its elegant curves was still recognisable, and as heavy rain had fallen in the night, the hole gave off something of the desolate, acrid smell he'd caught the first day. He walked out along the strand westwards, meaning to climb by his usual path behind the cricket pitch. But after he'd been going for some time, he saw a moving object in the sea. At this point, he was well above the ordinary high tide mark in a region where the most uncommon storms, like that which had destroyed the Diane, cast up massive debris, among which there grew interesting plants, sometimes with surprising speed. He sat, pleasantly shaded by ferns, on the trunk of a medang, and drew out his pocket glass. As soon as it was focused, his first opinion was confirmed. He was gazing into the large, insipid, kindly, square-nosed face of a dugong. It was not the first he'd seen, but it was the first in these waters. And certainly he'd never had a finer view at any time. A young female dugong, about
8 feet long, with her child. Sometimes she held it to her bosom with her flipper, both of them poised upright in the sea, staring straight before them in a very vacant manner. And sometimes she browsed on the seaweed that grew on the rocks out there. But at all times she showed the utmost solicitude for her child, occasionally going so far as to wash its face, which seemed a pointless task in so limpid a sea. Was her presence, and that of some fellow mermaidens much farther out, a sign of the coming change of season? "How glad I am that the boat is still only a hypothesis," he said, having pondered on the question. "Otherwise it would have been my duty to pursue the innocent dugong. They're said to be excellent eating, like poor Stellar's sea cow. Or rather, Stellar's poor sea cow, the creature." Presently the dugong dived and swam away to join her friends browsing on the far side of the reef, and Stephen was thinking of getting up when a strangely familiar sound caught his ear. "You'd swear it was a pig rooting," he said, moving his head slowly to the right. It was, in fact, a pig rooting, as fine a babaroosa as he'd ever seen. The animal was snorting and grunting at a great rate, wholly intent upon a wealth of tumours. It presented a perfect target, and Stephen very gently brought up his gun. The babaroosa was as innocent as the dugong. He shot it dead without the least compunction. When at last he'd hoisted the boar into a tree with his tackle, he said, 22 score if he weighs an ounce. Mother of God, how happy they'll be. I shall follow the back track as far as I can. Never was such a day for tracks, to see where he came from. And then I believe I shall indulge myself with a few of the swifts. I feel no resentment against them now, I find none at all. And I wish to see the state of the vacated nests. Poor little reed, alas, will never climb down to take them for me. But heavens, what youth and stamina and a cheerful mind will do in the face of a shocking injury. He'll be running about in a fortnight, whereas the boatswain, middle-aged and sunk in gloom, will take a great while to recover from a far less serious wound. His mind ran on in this way as he followed the clear track as far as a much-favoured wallow in the upper part of the island. In earlier days he would have seen a dozen tracks or more, new or old, converging upon this shallow pool of mud. Now there was but this single line coming from the northeast. "I should branch off here," he said, by the tree from which he had shot an earlier boar, and he walked uphill to the edge of the northern cliffs. But he was still quite far from the precipice when he skirted what had been a puddle in the night and was now a broad patch of mud. Soft mud. On its farther edge, as clear as well could be, he saw a child's footprint. Nothing leading to it, nothing leading from it. Either that child is preternaturally agile and leapt a clear 8 feet, or it was an angel setting 1 foot on earth, he said, his search in the low scrub on either side having revealed nothing. We have no ships by anything like so small. Another 100 yards resolved the puzzle. Near the edge of the precipice, where he'd lain with his head down the narrow cleft, the same cleft down which reed was to have been lowered, stood 7 baskets, filled with the finest nests and carefully wedged with stones. And if that wasn't clear enough, there was a junk lying offshore with boats going to and from the little sandy cove. When he'd sat there for some minutes, his mind turning over the various possibilities, he heard children's voices down among the trees. They were raised in anger, mockery, challenge and defiance, in Malay or Chinese, indifferently. They rose in a shrill crescendo that ended with a distinct thump, a scream of pain, and a concerted wail. Stephen walked down and found 4 children under a tall medung, 3 little girls howling with woe, 1 little boy groaning with pain and grasping his bloody leg. They were all Chinese, all dressed in much the same way, with pads on their knees and elbows for cave climbing. They turned to him and stopped howling.
Lipo said we could go and play when we'd gathered 7 baskets,
said one girl in Malay.
We never meant him to go right up to the top, said another. It's not our fault. Lipo will whip us past all bearings, said the third. We're only girls.
And she began grizzling again. Stephen's appearance didn't astonish or alarm them. He too was dressed in wide, short trousers, an open jacket and a broad hat, while his face, so long exposed to the sun, was now a disagreeable yellow. And the little boy, who in any case was partly stunned, let him examine the leg without resistance. Having more or less staunched the blood with his handkerchief and made his diagnosis, Stephen said, "Lie quite still and I'll cut you 7 splints." This he did with his hunting knife, and although time pressed with very great urgency, professional conscience obliged him to trim them before cutting his thin cloth jacket into strips for pads and bandages. He worked as fast as ever he could, but the little girls, calmed by his grown-up competent presence, talked faster still. The eldest, Mai Mai, was the boy's sister, and their father was Li Po, the owner of the junk. They'd come from Batavia to fetch a cargo of ore from Ketapan and Borneo, and, as they did every season when the wind was favourable and the sea calm, they deviated from their course for the Bird's Nest Island. When they were very young, they'd had ropes lowered from above, but now they didn't need them. They came right up from the bottom using pegs driven in here and there in the bad places. But generally it was quite easy to creep along the ledges and slopes, carrying a small basket in one's teeth and filling the large ones at the top. Only thin people could get through in some places. Li Po's brother, the one who was killed by Dayak pirates, had grown too fat by the time he was 15. "There," said Stephen, gently tying a final knot. "I believe that will answer. Now, my dear, you must go down at once and tell your father what has happened. Tell him I am a medical man, that I have treated the wound, and that I am going to carry your brother to our camp on the south side. He cannot possibly be lowered to the junk in this state. Tell Li Po there are 100 Englishmen in a fortified camp nearly opposite the reef, and that we shall be happy to see him as soon as he can bring the junk round. Now, run along like a good child and tell him all will be well. The others may go with you or come with me, just as they choose." They chose coming with him, out of a desire for novelty, an unwillingness to see Li Po just at present, and the glory of carrying the rifle. The path was narrow, their legs short, and they had either to run in front of him and talk over their shoulders, or else behind and call out to the back of his head as he carried the boy. For there was no question of their not talking, with so much to communicate and so many important things to learn. The slimmer of the two, whose eyes had that extraordinary purity of curve only to be seen in Chinese children, wished Stephen to know that her best friend in Batavia, whose name could be interpreted Golden Flower of Day, possessed a striped Dutch cat. No doubt the old gentleman had already seen a striped Dutch cat. Would the old gentleman like to hear an account of the plants in their garden and of the betrothal ceremonies of their Aunt Wang? This had a catalogue of the varieties of edible birds' nests with their prices, lasted almost to the edge of the forest, and they could be heard from the camp well before their forms could be seen.
"Lord, Jack,"
said Stephen when the boy had been put into a cot with a basket over his leg and Ahmed at hand to comfort him, and when the little girls had been turned loose to admire the wonders of the camp, "there's a great deal to be said for the Confucian tradition."
"So my old nurse always used to tell me," said Jack. "Just let me send for your blessed gazelle, and then tell me where you found them and why you're looking so pleased." "The tradition, or shall I say doctrine, of infinite respect for age. As soon as I told that worthy child to run along like a good girl, now she stood up, bowed with her hands clasped before her, and ran off. It was the turning point, the crisis. Either all was wrecked or all succeeded. Had she proved froward or stubborn or disobedient, I was lost. The animal is behind and rather beyond the cricket field, in a tree one half blackened by lightning, one half green. That is how I shall bring up my daughter.
Don't you wish you may succeed? Bondon there, Bondon. The doctor has saved our bacon again.
Has saved our bacon!
So, take three more hands and a stout spar to the lightning-struck tree by the cricket pitch as quick as ever you like. Now, sir, turning to Stephen. Now, sir, prepare to be amazed. There is a vast junk with empty holds lying off the north side of the island. The children had come ashore to collect edible birds' nests. I believe the vessel will come round as soon as the wind serves, and I think it likely that its owner and captain will carry us back to Batavia. That boy in splints is his son, and I have drafts on Shou Yen, a Batavia banker he must necessarily know, drafts that will certainly pay our passage. And if his demands are not exorbitant, they leave enough over for some modest vessel that may still enable us to keep our rendezvous in New South Wales, or even before.
Oh, Stephen, cried Jack, what a glorious thought.
He beat his hands together as he did when he was very deeply moved, and then said, he'd better not be exorbitant. By God, rendezvous. With this wind we should be in Batavia in 3 days at the most, and if Raffles can help us to something that'll swim at something better than 5 knots, we have time in hand for a much earlier rendezvous. Time and to spare. Lord, how providential that you happened to be by when the poor boy broke his leg. Perhaps hurted would be more exact. I will not absolutely certify the fracture. But he has splints on. Well, in such cases, one cannot be too careful. How pleasantly the breeze is freshening. If your junk is at all weatherly, and I'm sure she's a wonderfully weatherly craft, it should bring her round by the afternoon. Just how big is she? I mean, he added, seeing the look of deep stupidity in Stephen's face, what does she displace? What's her tonnage? What does she weigh? Oh, I cannot tell. Shall we say 10,000 tons? What a fellow you are, Stephen, cried Jack. The surprise don't gauge 600. How does your blessed junk compare with her? Dear surprise, said Stephen, and then, recollecting himself, I do not let on to be an expert in nautical affairs, you know, but I think the junk, though not so long as the surprise, is distinctly fatter and swims higher in the sea. I'm fully persuaded that there is room for everybody sitting close and for what possessions we may have left.
If you please, sir, said Killick, dinner's on table.
Killick, said Jack, smiling on him in a way that Killick would have found incomprehensible if he hadn't been listening attentively. We've not put all our wine into the common pool yet, have we?
Well, no, sir, which there's grog for all hands today.
Then rouse out a couple of bottles of the O'Brien with the long cork, the 89. And tell my cook to knock up something to stay the little girl's hunger till the gazelle comes in. To Stephen, he said, the O'Brien should go well with the Dublin horse, ha! Ain't I a rattle? You smoked it, Stephen, didn't you? No reflection upon your country, of course, God bless it. Mere lightness of heart. Chuckling, he drew the cork, passed Stephen a glass, raised his own and said, here's to your glorious, glorious junk, that timeliest junk that ever yet was seen. The glorious junk appeared round the point before the end of the second bottle and began beating up for the anchorage. Before we drink our coffee, I shall just look at that dressing, said Stephen. Mr. Macmillan, he called in the hospital tent, be so good as to give me 2 elegant splints and white bandage galore. They unwound the strips of jacket and swabbed the scratch quite clean. "Something of a sprain, do I see, sir?" said Macmillan, and considerable tumescence about the external malleolus, but where's the break? Why the splint? It may exist only in the form of an imperceptible crack, said Stephen, but we must bind it up with as much care and attention as if it were a compound fracture of the most untoward kind, and we shall anoint it with hog's lard mixed with Cambodian bole. Returning to his coffee, he observed that Jack Aubrey, light-hearted though he was, hadn't overlooked the necessity for a show of strength. The earthwork was bristling with armed men, all clearly visible from the junk. Li Po came up the hill, therefore, with a submissive, deprecating air, accompanied only by a youth carrying a contemptible box of dried lychees and a canister of discreditable green tea. Li Po begged the learned physician's acceptance of these worthless articles, mere shadowy tokens of his respectful gratitude, and might he see his son? The little boy couldn't have played his part better. He moaned, groaned, rolled his eyes with anguish, spoke in a faint and dying voice, and shrunk petulantly from his father's caressing hand. "Never mind," said Stephen. "His suffering will be less once we're afloat. I shall attend him every day, and when I remove these bandages in Batavia, you will find his leg perfectly whole."